Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. Thank you for subscribing, downloading, and rating. We really appreciate it. Doing something slightly different this week. There's no news round, but we're going to bring you two really interesting features. One incredible piece of work by the Max Planck Institute of Animal Research. They're connecting satellites with animals to try and understand where animals and birds are going. And we're also going to talk about Huntington's disease and where we are with cures for this horrific degenerative condition. If you'd like to get in touch with the program, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. We get to all of your comments at the end of the show. So first up, if you own a smartwatch or a fitness tracker, you'll know that they teach you all sorts of interesting things about your behaviors and patterns. Some of them not necessarily things you want to hear, but they're probably important to know. What if we could do this with animals and understand what it is they're doing and where they're going? This is the basic concept behind the Icarus Project. Martin Michalski is the director at Max Planck Institute of Animal Behavior and the man behind the project. He joins me now. Welcome to the program, Martin. The idea that that we want to monitor animals, but actually it's quite difficult to do so. This isn't new, right? The idea that if we want to see animals in the wild, it's difficult to do that if they live in the wild.
Yes. So the idea has been around since the 60s, but it's really been difficult to do, especially on a global scale. And now, you know, we have new technology analyzing the behavior of animals on board, AI on these little wearables, and then only sending the summary of what they're doing. And that's really exciting.
So talk to me about the Icarus Project. What exactly are you doing?
Well, we have launched a satellite. Actually, two are now up in orbit and are being commissioned to track very small tracking tags, wearables on the ground anywhere on the globe. And that is a bottom-up, a community-based system where we as a science community have launched these satellite systems and are now starting to work on species that are roaming our planet and really get this information and develop this into a new Earth observation system.
So the two parts of this I find really interesting. The first are the satellites. Who owns these satellites and who launched them into space?
So they are owned actually by the Max Planck Society, and the second one is half owned by National Geographic Society. So we teamed up with them, our colleagues here, and we launched it with SpaceX because that's the easiest, the quickest, the safest for now. But there are more launches becoming online, small launches for low Earth orbit in the near future.
That's really, really cool. So you have your own satellites in space tracking the movement of animals. But only the ones that are wearing these tags that you've put on them on the ground, is that right?
Yes, that's correct, because you need a special communication system. You can imagine this is complicated. It's actually the highest communication engineering that you can get. We only need 7 milliwatts to get the information up. It's 30 decibel below noise, below background noise. So it's a very nifty system.
How does it work? You attach an electronic tag to an animal and then it beams up. Is it low energy Bluetooth or something like that?
It's similar to that. It's exactly like that. So the animal has a tag. It either has a battery or it has a solar panel or both to run forever. And then it is very energy efficient. It only sends the information maybe once a day or every few hours, depending. And then only very little information. So it analyzes the behavior of the animal on board on the tag, and then sends the summary to the satellite when the satellite is overhead.
Wow. And how big are these tags?
Well, the big ones are now actually 4 to 5 grams. So like a little finger. Wow. The smallest ones that are coming in fall this year and then will be used next year on small migrating birds, they're only 1 gram. And that's really where we always wanted to be, because we want to track, you know, the bats across the world, the small birds like swifts. We want to do swifts and swallows to really understand where these aerial insectivores are going into Africa, into Indonesia, into the Congo, into the Amazon. And then, you know, have a global connectivity of these information systems.
1 gram, that's extraordinary. A single gram on the back of a bird will allow you to monitor, not quite in real time, right? As you say, it sort of burst packets every once in a while. So it'll tell you what it has been doing, but what sort of level of accuracy in terms of, you know, GPS positioning do you have from such a tiny device?
Yes. So in the 4 gram ones, and they are shrinking, we have GPS accuracy. In the 1 gram ones, we do some kind of nifty location algorithms and we get it down to a 5 kilometer radius. But, you know, on that scale, going from, you know, Ireland to Angola or from Sweden to Ethiopia, that information is sufficient. And especially it's important that we want to understand, is the animal alive or dead? Because right. We need to understand where our animals are dying. We lost so many of those birds in Europe and in North America. So we need to understand what is happening to them when we don't see them.
I mean, this is so exciting because, as you say, you know, it's very difficult to monitor animals otherwise. I mean, once an animal is fully free, it's almost impossible unless you have some sort of lumpy tag on it. And usually those animals are quite large. How big a project is this? Like, how many animals and species are you planning on tagging?
Well, so we are starting with a small falcon project, 10 species of falcon this fall and next spring with the GPS tags. And then we want to do swifts around the world. So each of them, roughly about 2,000 individuals to get started with. But that's only our own projects. We hope that many other groups will join and, you know, buy their own tags. They're really cheap. And then do their own thing. I mean, all the bird banders that now use bands can then switch to, you know, electronic monitoring of what these animals are doing.
If I was a hobbyist ornithologist, or I was working on a bird species out in, you know, the plains of Africa, I could switch out the bands, put this device on, and then would I have access to the information that Max Planck is collecting?
Absolutely. I mean, it's the information primarily is owned by the people who do the work and by the locals who sort of own the land where these animals are. So we want to have all the information as open as possible, except for endangered species.
I was going to ask in terms of the endangered species or species that are hunted for trophies or for selling of parts, like rhinos, for example. Is there a danger of having this information easily accessible, knowing exactly where an animal is at any particular time?
Not really, because the system is secure. I mean, as secure as your bank account. And so far, we had no breach of security. We have lots of rhinos on track and endangered species. So we think it's as safe as it can get.
Is there any fear that these devices might be interfered with by the animals?
Well, yes and no. I mean, you can have a lion bite on the tag of a pangolin when it wants to eat it, and that may kill the tag. But usually, they are so robust that they withstand all of that. So overall, I think the biggest issue is really an ethical one. Are we allowed to tag these animals, to sort of give them something that they have to carry with them? That's why we want to do it as small as possible, really as a wearable. And we're also testing that before we do it on animals, on a different species. So that's always our main concern, that the animals are safe and that they have a good life, even if they have a little wearable.
So do you need to tag a lot of animals in a particular flock or herd, or is it, you know, limiting if you only have a couple of tags to really know what's going on with that group, for example? In other words, if there was a particular attack that happened and you saw the panicked flight of a particular type of bird, if there was only one bird that moved or one bird stayed, you wouldn't really have a full picture of what was actually going on. How completist do you need to be with these animals to have a good idea of what's really happening in terms of their movement?
Well, for information, more is always better. But for the animals, less is always better. You know, fewer animals that you ask to provide their information. So we have the same issue as the opinion poll people. We have to find out what's the sweet spot. How many do we need to tag to really understand what's going on? And that is something that is coming. That's something we don't know yet for many species.
Talk to me about Okambara and this incredible story during 2024.
Yes. So, I mean, Okambara, so we tagged a whole lot of animals there to try to see whether they can tell us whether poachers are coming through or hunters are coming through. Because when you have a tag on a rhino and the rhino calls in and says, I'm in trouble, then it's usually too late. So you need the other animals to really tell you, hey, there's some trouble coming your way, or there's some trouble going through the savannah. And they have their eyes and their ears and their noses all over the place. And if they all panic because somebody's walking through there, then we can really say, oh, there's danger coming towards the rhino or towards some other problem species. So that's a really important way to have animals protect animals via telling us what's happening.
And so you were able to see in the data that there was some sort of panic that was causing movement and fleeing of various species, and you knew, okay, there's probably poachers there. Is that the idea?
Yes, that's the idea. We simulated that ourselves, had some, you know, hunters going through and pretending they're poachers, and that does work. But I think the problem is more that, you know, you need the enforcement of the protection system. And since the poaching of rhino horn, for example, is more like a mafia structure, you have to fight it in different ways than really fight it locally. Animals can't tell you what's happening, but we found that, you know, the more important part is really the enforcement of these systems on a larger scale and more like how you deal with criminal organizations.
Yeah, I would absolutely agree with that. In terms of the amount of information that you get, what exactly is each tag tracking? Obviously, GPS location, but what else?
Well, they all get acceleration, which is, you know, the movement of a body in space. And that tells you the behavior of the animal to some extent, sometimes very precisely, but also the energy expenditure. And then there are other features like temperature, humidity, wind conditions for flying animals. Wow. So it's a weather buoy, plus it's an environmental buoy and a wearable telling you what the state of this individual animal is all about.
With these satellites up in the sky, exactly how many animals can you monitor at once? What is the grand plan here?
Well, so it is scalable, so you can, you know, have thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands or millions around the world. If it's in one flock, you can't have thousands, you can only have hundreds, but that's probably never going to happen because these flocks never stay that close together. So it is a scalable system, and then we have, you know, five other satellites going up in the near future. But how many we need to really have a good information system about life on the planet is yet to be seen. So our aim for now is having 100,000 individuals around the globe to get started with, and then we'll see how good that information is and how valuable it is for people around the planet, which we think it is.
I am bragging here, but I was fortunate enough to be on the northeast coast of French Guiana to watch turtles nesting on a beach. And as they returned back to the ocean, we were tasked with putting some epoxy resin and sticking a tracker on the back of these turtles to try and understand their patterns, because once they went into the water, they were just almost impossible to track. And the problems with those trackers were that over a, you know, reasonably short amount of time, they just fell off. And I'm wondering, what about the underwater animals who many of whom are at real risk? Is there just no solution for them at the moment? Like this?
Well, that is a problem because you don't get GPS and you don't really get good communication underwater.
Yeah.
Or you need a different system. So what you can do is exactly what you did. You put the tags on and then eventually you let them collect data and then you pop them to the surface and then you transmit to a satellite. So that's what we want to do on some of the species, eels and other
eels.
Fish in the ocean.
How are you going to stick something to an eel?
Yes, I mean, that's overdue because we want to know, you know, do they really go to the Sargasso Sea and how many of them go there and where do these eels really go? And so far, the tags that have been used were just way too large. So yeah, they expose the eels to predation. But with these very small tags, you can do it now. So this is all within reach now.
It's so exciting and so interesting. And, you know, watching documentary series like David Attenborough, you know, you get this idea that we understand everything and we know everything about all species, but actually we know so little about migrating animals in particular and where they go and what they do and what sort of impact human activity is having on them. So this is an extraordinary project. Just finally, is there any chance that we might be able to have real-time information in the future, Martin? The idea that we'd be able to poll an animal at any time and see exactly where it is right that second?
We can already do that, for example, on these terrestrial systems in Namibia. And the idea is, and that's working now, to combine terrestrial and space systems so that, you know, you can communicate on the ground if there is connectivity, and then it's real time. And then a space communication when you need it. And that is right now near real time. I mean, it's, you know, a few times a day or so. But there is also talk about expanding the system and making it into a system that you have connectivity every 10 minutes or so, which would then be almost real time. But that is something to see in the future. It's possible. It's just a question of money. It's not a lot of money, but still, you know, as a ground up, a bottom up community, it's always hard to find these funds.
Really, really interesting work, Martin. Keep up all of your efforts to understand these species. I'm really looking forward to hearing some of the results of your data in the next year or so. Martin Michalski is a director at Max Planck Institute of Animal Behavior.
Thank you.
Yes, welcome back to Future Proof on News Talk. I'm Jonathan McRae. Now, there have been lots of exciting developments in recent years in the treatment of major neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's or Parkinson's. But Huntington's disease affects a much smaller cohort of the population and still remains a devastating diagnosis with no cure. So will we see progress with this condition in our lifetime? Well, Andrea Kravgotsky is an associate professor of pharmacology and therapeutics at the University of Galway. She joins me now. Welcome to the program, Andrea. Remind us, if you don't mind, what Huntington's disease is and how someone gets that.
Huntington's disease is a rare type of dementia. And as other dementias like Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's disease, Huntington's disease also affect cognition. So basically our thinking abilities, memory, and learning. But Huntington's disease also is a movement disorder. And it's a different type of movement disorder compared to Parkinson's, because in Huntington's, we see this very characteristic dance-like movements as the disease progresses, and it's called chorea. Later, Huntington's disease patients, they can also present with Parkinson's-like movement problems, like initiation of movements, fine control of movements. But Huntington's disease also affects emotion processing and causes psychiatric problems in patients. So it has a very broad impact on the person. And here I should mention that based on the symptom characteristics, actually the people with Huntington's disease, they are categorized into different symptom profiles. So in some people, when the disease starts, they will experience movement problems as a first issue. By other people, they will have psychiatric problems. Very often, the first signs of the disease will be depression, anxiety, and mood problems. But other people, they will experience all these symptoms at the same time. And besides these main symptoms, there are also other problems like sleep disturbances, problems with swallowing, and other issues.
As a degenerative disease, when someone has Huntington's, they will always die early. Is that right? What is the life expectancy of someone who has Huntington's disease?
This is variable. And Huntington's disease, importantly, is a genetic disorder. Mm. For Alzheimer's, only 3-4% of the cases are genetic. But in Huntington's disease, everyone carries the mutation of the Huntington gene, and they will develop during their lifetime the disease. I should mention that in the genetic code, there is a repeat in the Huntington's disease, in the Huntington gene. And then the number of the repeats, they will determine when the person might develop the disease. So in very rare cases, the disease onset can be when someone is in their 20s, but these are extreme cases. In that case, they might carry like 60 or even higher repeats of this gene, wow, of this expansion. If the person carries 36 repeats, it's very likely they will develop. But everyone who carries 40 or above, they will develop the disease during their lifetime. But even in identical twins, the onset of the disease is not the same. So this complicates the situation and tells us that environmental factors and lifestyle can most likely, and maybe even other disease processes, you know, other disorders that might affect the person, they can influence the disease onset. Usually, people with Huntington's, they will have earlier onset than those with Alzheimer's, but still the risk factor is age. So as we are aging, there is more likely that people will develop Huntington's disease if they carry the gene.
Right. But in terms of life expectancy, I remember interviewing someone a long time ago, and they live with Huntington's disease, and they had given me a very low age life expectancy. But it seems from some of the research that some people don't develop it until quite late in their lives.
Exactly.
Would that mean they would be symptom free late in their
yes.
lives? But typically,
yes.
typically the average lifespan is shorter because of the devastating effect of this these
yes.
neurological symptoms. Is that right?
Yes, exactly. And if someone has this very early onset disease, they might die really, the disease progression might be really fast. So they might live with it for a few years only. If it develops around midlife, again, it's very variable, but some people live with it like for a decade or longer. But as you mentioned, some people will develop the disease about their 70s, 80s.
Right. So this condition, is it an autoimmune response that's causing this neurodegeneration, or is there some other factors at play? Do we know what causes Huntington's?
In Huntington's disease, we know that there is this gene mutation, and that's the main cause of the disease. But what exactly this mutation is causing, what kind of changes in the body and in the brain, that's not so obvious still. We know that it leads to the accumulation of the mutant Huntington protein itself. This will result in neuroinflammation as the protein aggregates, but also the dying nerve cells, they release different kind of factors, you know, and are immune cells are trying to clear that from the brain. There is the release of inflammatory molecules. So inflammation is the main characteristic of the disease.
So we have lots of inflammation therapies available to us. We have lots of approaches to things like autoimmune diseases now, although many of them are still unsolved. Do we have an approach, even theoretically, for how we might be able to treat or slow down the development of Huntington's disease?
Because we know that this immune component is really critical in disease progression. Of course, there have been clinical trials with Huntington's disease. They were trying more general approaches. Let's say we know that cannabinoids, they have anti-inflammatory properties. Some tetracycline derivatives, they have also anti-inflammatory properties. So some small trials have been run with this approach, but this is very broad. It doesn't target like a specific inflammatory pathway. And unfortunately, these trials, they didn't show much promise. But when I'm saying they were small, like the maximum number of participants, like they enrolled like 30, 40 Huntington's disease patients only. These are very, very low numbers.
Yeah.
If we want strong results, we need hundreds and thousands of people involved in these trials.
Right. And is that difficult to organize? Because you would imagine if you are diagnosed with Huntington's and there is a clinical trial happening, you would imagine that you'd want to at least take part, if not contribute to the overall understanding of the condition. Is it hard to recruit patients for a Huntington's trial, or is it just difficult logistically to get people from lots of different countries to coordinate and find funding for something when it's a rare disease?
Yeah, it's a rare disease. Obviously, like more focused was directed towards Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's disease. There are a higher number of people affected, but also that it's a rare disease. So we have relatively small patient cohorts. But on the other hand, because Huntington's disease is a genetic disease, we know who carries the gene, we know who will develop the disease. So this makes the clinical trials slightly easier than the Alzheimer's trials, for example. And there are worldwide initiatives, like it's called Enroll HD, and people from multiple sites all around the world, they are part of this project and they can be enrolled in clinical trials. So there are big developments in the field thanks to these initiatives.
Your research isn't focused on living patients, but the postmortem tissue of Huntington's patients. Tell me a little bit about what you're hoping to learn from this brain tissue that you're studying and what you've seen.
It's very important to study postmortem tissue from the people who have the disease, actually, because there are many preclinical studies, but the real molecular changes that occur in the human brain, they can be only studied with the Huntington's disease cases. And we study the molecular mechanisms of the disease, its progression in the brain. Our main focus is finding drug targets and novel approaches, testing them, you know, like how we can modulate these pathways. And in this case, the main focus of this study was neuroinflammation and understanding the differences of the inflammatory process between Huntington's disease patients with different symptom profiles.
Yeah. To try and understand why someone might develop psychiatric symptoms with the same disease, the same gene, and another might develop physical symptoms first, and others might develop both at the same time. In terms of the genes, are they the same allele, so a version of the gene that we see every time when we look at Huntington's patients, even though they experience different symptoms? Is it the exact same version of that defective gene?
There are slight differences, right, of course, but the main difference is really that people carry a different number of the repeats.
I see.
And this itself can lead to different symptom profiles, but also like where this mutant Huntington protein accumulates in the brain. Mm. It's different in every person.
How do you get donated brain tissue from someone from Huntington's, and how do you process something like that to get valuable information from it?
Again, because Huntington's disease is a rare disease, very few places around the world, they are specifically focusing on collecting Huntington's disease brains. And what is very important for our research, we have to know the clinical background information related to these cases. So if we just got a brain, you know, we know that the person had Huntington's disease and we don't have the information about the CAG repeat numbers, disease onset, and many other clinical characteristics, then we can't make all these conclusions what we were able to do now. So I was sourcing the human brain tissue from the Neurological Foundation Human Brain Bank from the University of Auckland in New Zealand. Mm. They have a really nice cohort of people involved in this project. Many people will donate their brains once they find out that they carry the mutation. They will sign up for the program.
So in this case, you have a rich patient history. You have someone who understands they have the condition and they understand the importance of donating that brain tissue, and that then you access that data to run your research. What about that diagnosis then? When someone is told that they have Huntington's, is that then something where all of the family members always get tested, or do some people just not want to know? And how does that affect the possibility of eradicating Huntington's in a global population?
Yes, and that's a very, very difficult decision for everyone and for every family, how they want to deal with this situation. And very often family members don't agree. Many would like to be tested immediately and find out, while others not. But of course, you know, if someone is being tested, they find out that they carry the gene, it means other family members will know as well that they might be affected. So it's very often like a disagreement between family members, what should be done. And it's a difficult situation.
But in terms of passing that gene on, do most young adults who are diagnosed with this, if they want to become parents, do they choose IVF to be able to select out that gene? Or is that not always a decision that someone makes?
That was a breakthrough, actually. And because before people were afraid having children, you know, that they will pass on the gene. But nowadays we have the option and we can choose the healthy embryos. And actually, this is the life stage for many people. Like, let's say they at early stages of their life, they don't want to be tested. But when they want to have family, they decide to have the genetic testing so that they know that they will they need to worry about passing on the gene or not. Right. But even if we can have this genetic testing, it's just simply not possible to completely eliminate this mutation from the population, because very often the families don't know that anyone carried the gene in the family. Yeah. Like, I recently met a family that they knew that a grandfather has been diagnosed with very serious Parkinson's disease. And actually, that was a misdiagnosis. The person had Huntington's disease. So, of course, future generations are affected as well. And a couple of decades ago, many people, instead of being treated for Huntington's disease, they were admitted to psychiatric units and they were treated there. And actually, they had Huntington's and they were never diagnosed.
So presumably now, as the advancement of genetic testing gets cheaper, more prolific, we recognize these symptoms, we're aware of them. Presumably in the next century or so, we will be able to have a much clearer idea. And simply because people decide to get tested, decide to do IVF, we're going to see a lot less proliferation in the general public. And presumably, almost by numbers, we'll see the cases of Huntington's dropping. I mean, we presumably see that already, do we?
We don't see yet. Actually, we are seeing an increase because we are living longer. So those people who would never develop Huntington's disease, they are developing now because they are surviving longer.
Okay.
Also, many people committed suicide before they have been diagnosed before. And that's another reason people don't know that there is Huntington's in the family. And nowadays, that we are starting to manage depression, anxiety better. So people might live longer and then they will be diagnosed with Huntington's later in life.
Yeah, it's both very, very sad and also very, very complicated.
Yeah.
But from a scientific point of view, very interesting to try and solve this problem and very pressing too. So thank you so much for talking to us about your work and your research. That was really interesting. We've talked about Huntington's on the program before, but I've learned so much from this. So thank you so much, Dr. Kwakowski from University of Galway. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
And that's it from us on this week's episode. Hope you enjoyed it. Thanks to Aidan McKelvey producing, Rory Galvin on podcast, and Hugo da Silva Scott on sound. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed on Tuesday. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Sundays from midday on News Talk.